From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with actor Dennis Franz. He played Lieutenant Norman Bunce on TV's Hill Street Blues. He returns as Bunce in a spin-off series this fall. Also today, I speak with photographer Eve Arnold. Her new book is an appreciation of Marilyn Monroe on the 25th anniversary of her death. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new reissue of Arturo Toscanini conducting works by Berlioz. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg describes how the word impact, which has always been a noun, now has a second life as a verb. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is actor Dennis Franz, who played Lieutenant Norman Bunce on the TV series Hill Street Blues. Bunce was a cocky, tough-talking, gum-chewing cop who was always ready to bend the rules to get the job done, which constantly got him into trouble with the captain. Physically, Bunce was hard to miss, a stocky, balding man dressed in wide ties and polyester suits. Many Hill Street viewers thought Dennis Franz stole the show when he joined the cast in 1985. Here's a scene where Bunce is trying to cut a deal with defense attorney Joyce Davenport.
Miss Davenport.
I'm short on time, Lieutenant.
This won't take long.
If you're leading up to some kind of deal, I've already told the DA my client's not interested.
Your client's a flea, Miss Davenport. He's a microscopic particle. It's the people who hired him we want.
I've told you, Lieutenant, we're not looking for any deals. I'm due in court.
This is a deal with a difference, please. Seeing Higby's definitely going to do some time, probably a lot. The only question is what kind of time he's going to do, considering his condition.
What condition?
You're familiar with the exact nature of Higby's wound.
Lieutenant.
The way it lightened him up, I mean. So now he's a little short in the crucial equipment department.
I'm listening.
If Higby's fellow inmates were to somehow find out how he ain't the man he used to be, how he ain't even a man at all, so to speak.
You're saying he'd be abused?
As in badly.
And unless Higby names his alleged employers, you'd see to it that somebody got the word out. That offer is astoundingly improper, Lieutenant. You try it and I'll hit you with a restraining order.
Just tell him what I told you, all right?
I'll, of course, relay to Mr. Higby anything that's relevant to his case.
That's all we can ask, Counselor.
When NBC canceled Hill Street last season, Franz got his own spin-off series called Beverly Hills Bunce, which airs on NBC this fall. It's a comedy drama that picks up where Hill Street left off. Bunce is off the force, working as a private investigator, and still relying on his snitch, Sid, played by Peter Jurasik, who also played the role on Hill Street. Dennis Franz grew up in Chicago, where he got his start in theater. His movie credits include several films by the director Brian De Palma, including Dressed to Kill and Body Double. Dennis Franz is joining us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. Hi, Dennis Franz, and welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Hi, how are you?
Okay. Was the character of Lieutenant Norman Bunce written expressly for you, with you in mind?
When the producers of Hill Street Blues, David Milch and Jeffrey Lewis, approached me about actually returning back to the show, because I had been on prior to that 2 years as another character, Sal Benedetta. When they approached me about coming back, we didn't know exactly in what form I was going to come back. All they knew and all we had kind of surmised at that point was the character was going to be somehow abrasive, and he was going to stir up the pot, and he was going to be an odd nickel, and it was going to be one that was going to create some new problems for Ferrillo and the rest of the gang over at Hill Street.
I'm trying to listen to see how much you had to change your speech style to do the character of Bunce.
I'm from Chicago, and I guess I know when I can turn it on or turn it off, and given the right dialogue and my comfortable speech patterns are not like Bunce, but if I'm given that dialogue and I'm given that way of speaking, I can turn it on.
You had some gestures that you worked out that seemed so perfectly suited to the character. One of them was, of course, the way you chewed gum. And you chew it not only to show your cockiness, but you'd also, like, pop it into your mouth as punctuation in a conversation. Was that ever written in, or did you just come up with that?
No, that, in fact, the whole gum chewing thing came about when I was on the set the first couple of days, and I was trying to be comfortable on the set. I started chewing gum, and nobody objected when I started using it as the character. And then, in fact, when I saw it in the opening credits, I thought, well, now I'm stuck with it, so I got to go with it. And so I did use it as that. It's been a fun thing to play with. Everybody has their little gimmicks that they like to use. Telly Savalas had his lollipops, and I got my gum. And not only do we use it as punctuation and attitudes, but I've used them as peace offerings, too. When I am befriending somebody and want to give them some sort of a gift, I'll offer them a piece of gum.
You also had a kind of nervous gesture that I thought was perfect for the character. When you'd step out of a car or when you're prepared to walk into a room or you're bracing yourself to walk in, you would just adjust your jacket a little bit, tug it down a little bit.
Yeah, I think that was kind of... me trying to fit into my body. I think those of us who are carrying around a little too much weight are always doing that, and we're always kind of adjusting our clothes to fit ourselves and trying to make our outer skin fit our inner bodies. So that's where that came from. And yeah, you're right. I use it exactly at those times.
Something else that everybody, I think, thinks of your character for is the loud patterns, the fat ties, the polyester suits. Was it your idea to dress that way?
In fact, that was the exact opposite of what I had in mind. As I had mentioned before, I was on as another character, and that character was pretty slick. And when I thought that he was coming back, when I was coming back in some sort of form as the other Sal Benedetto character, My image was one. We didn't even have the name. We didn't have a name. We didn't have a wardrobe. We really didn't have anything planned on the character. When I was thinking about wardrobe, I thought him in maybe not expensive clothes, but a little more tasteful than he was given to wear on the show. The first time I came in for a costume fitting and I saw all these polyesters and these clashing colors, I thought, oh boy, this something's off here, because first they've thrown his name at me, Norman Bunce, which I wasn't too thrilled about to begin with, and then they've given me this weird clothes, and I thought, our concepts are getting real strange here. So I kind of realized that what they wanted was we were after a list of contradictions in character, and I've described Norman Bunce as sort of a human mutt, and that he does have a lot of different characteristics, and they don't all fit into the same person. But somehow it's interesting to watch that, and my reasoning in why he chooses his clothes, I think he really feels that that he's dressing pretty sharp. He just has
bad taste
in clothes. As long as everything he's wearing has brown in it, regardless of the pattern or which direction those patterns are going in, that's fine. He looks pretty swell, you know, as far as he's concerned, because they're all brown and blue or green or whatever the color may be.
Were you able to base your portrayal of the Bunce character, which you're going to continue in Beverly Hills Bunce, were you able to base that character on anyone you knew? And I guess I'm wondering, too, if you grew up in a tough neighborhood in Chicago or a working-class neighborhood in Chicago where you were apt to meet people like him.
I grew up in a suburb out of Chicago. It was about 7 miles out of the city proper in Maywood. The area was, yes, very much of a working-class neighborhood. My father was a postal worker, and he worked in a factory, and my mother also worked at the post office. There was a heavy, tough element in our neighborhood. We had gangs. I wasn't a part of them, but a lot of my friends were members of gangs, and therefore I had an association with them. I kind of walked a fine line always, because I kept those friends, and then when I got involved in theater, of course the gangs didn't want to have nothing to do with the theater, so I had both sides of the fence, and I was able to play both sides too. So I had different groups of friends that were complete opposites, and I guess I I guess it was a matter of me always observing, getting to your initial question about did I draw on any of anybody in particular to form the character. It's been sort of an observational existence that I've always had, watching the other sides and being in touch with both of them, but knowing how they work. But I don't specifically have one person that I can identify with in forming the character of Norman Bunce.
You said that the gang members that you knew didn't want any part of the theater part of your life. Was theater not masculine enough for them?
I guess that's what their problem was. It just seemed to me that there didn't seem to be anybody involved in plays that belonged to that particular group of people. If they were involved in any after-school activities, it was sports. Sports and smoking cigarettes and eating pizzas.
My guest is actor Dennis Franz, who played the role of Norman Bunce on Hill Street Blues, and he'll play that role again in a new series called Beverly Hills Bunce that premieres this fall. Now let's talk about your new show. How is the character going to compare? Are you going to have any of the same writers continuing the character for you?
They're all the same writers. In fact, the executive producers of the show, David Milch and Jeffrey Lewis, who have been the exec producers on Hill Street for the last 2 years, have been writing for Hill Street Blues for 7 years, and they've written the pilot episode, and they are going to be the head writers, if not the only writers, throughout the entire show. So yes, we have the same crew from Hill Street Blues. It's the same production company. We will be using the same directors that we used on Hill Street. It's coming out of MTM. So it really is an extension of the working process that put together Hill Street Blues.
So you don't have to worry about getting a makeover on the new series?
No. In fact, if we do anything too much, if we try to Californiaize this guy too much, we're going to lose Bunce, and we don't want to do that. He has to be a fish out of water. He has to be uncomfortable in his surrounding, and obviously a fish out of water, like you say, and along with Sid, who also, the difference, the funny part is, I mean, Bunce is aware that he's in California, he doesn't belong here, and he's not too really thrilled about being here. He's here for a couple of reasons. Number one is he's forced off the police force. He has to leave Hill Street Blues because in the last episode I punched the chief and I get fired from the police force. So he goes into private practice. He becomes a private investigator. He wants to get as far away from that land of Hill Street, wherever it is, which has never been determined, but we know it's out east somewhere. So the furthest he can get is go out west, and he's done some research, and he found that the most money and the most possible need for private investigators would be in the Los Angeles area. So he comes out here and he sets up in Beverly Hills. Now, he's not too thrilled about being here. He's not too thrilled with the people. He's not too thrilled with their diets, their clothes, anything about it. What's his name? Sid, on the other hand, has died and gone to heaven. This is paradise to him. So he's thrilled with this whole thing. And it sets up a lot of possible comedy there.
I want to ask you about a bit of acting that you did in one of the episodes that really impressed me with your skills of an actor. This is on Hill Street Blues, and it was an episode toward the end of the series where you were basically being held hostage and about to be killed by a couple of drug dealers who you had performed a scam on, and your partner, your new partner, had just been shot by them. And you're trying to stay really cocky and not let on how scared you are, but you're really scared, probably more scared than that character had ever been before in the series. And I thought, especially for television, it was really acting on multi-layers, you know, of showing that you're not scared but being terrified underneath.
Yeah, thank you for that. That came about actually the year before last, the first to the last season of Hill Street. And in that episode, that was a real turning point, in fact, I think, for audience feelings towards Bunce's character. Up to that point, he was kind of being thought of as a superhero and as an indestructible, almost, kind of person. That showed a real opposite side to him. In fact, the real bottom line to that episode that emphasized it, I think, was not the fact that he got out of that jam that he didn't seem possible for him to be able to get out of. But the effects that it had on him afterwards, if you'll remember, the final scenes were after he had gotten out of that. The first thing he had to do, he broke a date with this girl he'd been dying to have for a long time, and he had to break the date because he had a rough day. And so he goes into the men's room, and he's found retching in the men's room. So it really physically had an impact on him, and he was not the Superman that he was being built up to be. It really had an impact on his life, and that turned around a lot of viewers. In fact, I think they saw another side to Bunce, and this almost invincible person was vulnerable now, and so he this started to develop in different directions. I particularly enjoyed that episode. That was probably my favorite episode, and it was a wonderful opportunity. I think the actors that played opposite were equally good.
Yeah, that really was a really good episode. Dennis Franz, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is actor Dennis Franz, who played the role of Lieutenant Norman Bunce on Hill Street Blues, and will be back in that role in a spin-off series in the fall. The series will be called Beverly Hills Bunce. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actor Dennis Franz is my guest, and he's joining us from the NPR Los Angeles Bureau. Something very unprecedented happened on your career with Hill Street Blues. You first had a role as a bad cop called Sal Benedetto back in the 82-83 series. You were on a few episodes of that. The character commits suicide, and then they brought you back a few years later in the role of Norman Bunce. Mm-hmm. Did you want to leave? Did you ask to be let out of the series, or did they kill you off even though
you
wanted to stay?
I did everything possible to stay on that show. In fact, really the course of events was that they were in the process of creating a new show called Bay City Blues, and that was about a minor league baseball team. Stephen Bochco, Jeffrey Lewis, and some of the other people at Hill Street were putting this new show together. They asked me if I would be interested in being a regular on that show. I absolutely said yes. They went ahead and they made Benedetto as bad as they could, so it necessitated him having to take his life and be eliminated from the show. Once Bay City was not successful, we made 8 episodes and it was canceled. I made every possible overture to get back on Hill Street. I realized I'm very fortunate that I have been able to be a part of my favorite show on television, and I missed that opportunity. I missed being a part of it, and I without question wanted to be with them again. And I said, whatever hair I got left, you can dye blonde. I'll get rid of my mustache. I'll come back as Benedetto's gay brother seeking revenge. I'll do anything to get back on a show. That's how much I love everybody over there. So we weren't able to work that out. It took a couple of years for my character to be able to return in the form of Norman Bunce.
You know, earlier you were telling us that you knew a lot of gang members, though you never really belonged to the gangs when you were growing up in a working-class suburb of Chicago. How did you first get interested in acting? What drew you to theater?
A girl I was going out with, it was in my junior year of high school, and she was going to try out for a play called The Crucible. I went along with her. I was involved in 3 sports up to that time. I was involved in football, baseball, and swim. And this came around the time of the swim season. We were just starting that sport. I went with her to the auditions, and I sat in the room and I watched everybody audition. I didn't even realize up to that point that they had theater at my high school. That's how out of it I was. And I heard everybody auditioning and I heard the guys and I thought, gee, I can do as good as them. So kind of involuntarily, I found myself raising my hand and saying, could I try this? I ended up getting one of the leads, and I dropped out of the swim team for that season. I thought, well, if this is my least favorite of the sports anyway, so let me try this. So I tried that play. I thoroughly enjoyed the experience, so I went out for the next play, and one by one I started eliminating the sports and devoting myself full-time to theater. The girlfriend didn't get cast, by the way, so I lost her as a girlfriend, but I got the career out of the deal.
What kind of parts were you playing back then?
Well, believe it or not, I was playing leading man type parts. At that time, I looked different had a little more hair and was a little thinner. So I was playing a lot of leading men.
You know, something that really troubles me about television and films is that you have to have a lot of hair and be really slim and classically attractive to be a leading man or a leading lady.
That more often than not is the case. I think there have been exceptions to the rule, and I think...
I think you're an exception now, right? I mean, you're...
Well, thank you. Ed Asner, I was referring to, Jack Klugman, even on L.A. Law. You know, this question was brought up not too long ago at a press conference, and somebody was talking about... Somebody raised the question. They said, well, what kind of girl... They were talking about love interests in Beverly Hills Bunce. They said, what kind of girl is going to go for Norman Bunce? Well, my response is, just look at Jill Eikenberry and Michael Tucker, look around you anywhere, and you'll see matchups of people that don't necessarily always fit.
How did you start getting cast as the heavy in films? I don't know if you played the heavy in any theatrical roles before you started doing movies.
Yes, I was with a theater company in Chicago called the Organic Theater for 5 years, and during that period of time, we did a lot of different theater. It was a repertory company, and we worked continuously during that period of time. We had a chance to really play a wide range of roles, and so I had a chance at playing villains, monsters, nice guys, romantic guys, and a whole span of characters. Then I got involved with Brian De Palma. Brian De Palma and Robert Altman were shooting some films in Chicago at the time that I was thinking about leaving, and I got involved with both of their movies. One was The Fury that Brian De Palma was directing, and the other was A Wedding that Robert Altman had. I had small parts in both of those. One was a cop. In The Fury, I played a cop opposite Kirk Douglas. It was a small role, but it was a nice role. And then in the Altman film, A Wedding, I just had a teeny part that they had written in for me to become acquainted with Altman and kind of hopefully become a part of his entourage and his repertory company, which it worked out that way. I went from doing those two things that I was advised by both of them that if I wanted to do more, it was either to come out to New York or Los Angeles, and I thought I had stronger connections in Los Angeles, so I came to L.A., and consequently, I've been working ever since, and they have always been in the directions of being heavies. I think when people see you do something that they enjoy watching you do, they want to see you do more of it, and I'm not opposed to that. I think that I have other tricks up my sleeve, and I like the opportunity to show them. I don't know when I'm going to get that opportunity. I think part of it is going to be given to me during Beverly Hills Bunce. I think that they may be a chance with Brian De Palma to have an opportunity in the future for him to take a chance with me going in a different direction. I've done 4 movies with him. Dressed to Kill, I played a cop, not unlike the character that I play on Hill Street.
Yeah, no, exactly. It really does remind me of the character. And I was wondering what Brian De Palma taught you about your own potential as an actor.
Well, he really didn't teach me anything other than I was aware of his appreciation of what I was doing, and that encouraged me because I certainly respect him, and I thought, well, if he can appreciate what I'm doing, then there's something there. So I looked deeper for what I was doing. He's a wonderful actor's director, I will say that. When you're working with him, he gives you a lot of opportunity to improvise and to rehearse and to come up with things and offer suggestions. He's very open to change, and that's pretty unusual for directors, especially film directors of his stature.
A little earlier you mentioned that after your character committed suicide in the, was it 82, 83 series on Hill Street Blues, the Sal Benedetto character, you're willing to do anything to come back in a different role to Hill Street. When the series ended this year, were you sorry it was ending? You probably already knew you had a spin-off series, and I'm not sure if you were feeling, well, it's time for this to come to an end, or if you really would have preferred for it to continue.
I certainly would have preferred for it to continue. As I had said before, Hill Street Blues has been my favorite show, and I think to have the opportunity to be a part of it was certainly a gift, and one that I greatly appreciated and was not willing for it to end. I miss it on television. I miss watching it. Being a part of it was great, but being a viewer is also wonderful, and I feel like I'm missing something every week. I, though, was only on the show for 2 years as Norman Bunce, and some of the other characters who had expressed desire to leave, they had had 7 years of the characters that they had been playing, so it was a little more understanding on their parts that they were ready to move on and go on to something else, and I can appreciate that. So, but as far as I was concerned, no, I would have been very happy to stay on Hill Street. Now, the fact that I'm going on to this other show, I'm ready for the opportunity, and I think there's a real interesting show there, and I think there's one that's going to be a different type of a show. As you had mentioned, it's a half-hour dramatic comedy. It's kind of in the vein of Hill Street in the sense that it still has the real life feelings that Hill Street did. It's not sitcom. We don't stand and tell jokes, and we don't have a live audience. It's film. It's just filmed in Los Angeles, and it's a lighter in its look, and it focuses in on two characters as opposed to the 14, 15 characters that were written about weekly on Hill Street during their hour time slot. Now, it's a little more focused. It's brought in clearer because it's just on these two, maybe three characters.
A lot of actors who don't want to get recognized will wear large sunglasses, or if they're a woman, maybe tie a scarf on their head.
Seems to me, punch photographers.
Yeah, right. It seems to me if you didn't want to get recognized, all you'd need to do would be to wear a classic tweed jacket, since people associate your character with all the polyester and wide ties.
Well, that's true. I'm happy to say I don't dress like Norman on the street. And as far as people recognizing, that's always flattering to me. I enjoy that, and I enjoy talking to people, and they get a kick out of it when they don't see me in wide, ugly ties. They send them to me, though. I get a lot of gifts in the mail of some old ties that they found in their attics and things, and they send them over to me.
What do you do with them?
I try to fit them in on the show whenever possible. some of them are a little too outrageous because it's as I had mentioned before, I don't think Bunce really doesn't try to look silly. He doesn't do it on purpose. He just thinks that what he's wearing is fine. It's just bad taste. But he doesn't go out of his way to find funny-looking stuff.
Dennis Franz, I want to thank you very much for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for doing it. My guest has been actor Dennis Franz, and he played Lieutenant Norman Bunce on the TV series Hill Street Blues. He has a spin-off series that begins on October 29th, and that's called Beverly Hills Bunce. That's on NBC this fall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Molly Yard, the newly elected head of the National Organization for Women, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶ From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, photographer Eve Arnold talks about her sessions taking pictures of Marilyn Monroe, who died 25 years ago today. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of a previously overlooked recording of Arturo Toscanini conducting the NBC Orchestra in works by Berlioz. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the impact of the word impact in its new usage as a verb. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell. The Reagan administration today unveiled a plan that would end aid to the Nicaraguan Contras if a ceasefire were reached and if the Sandinista government agreed to democratic reforms. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The six-point plan has the backing of congressional leaders and the Contras. It calls for the two sides to lay down their arms and for Nicaragua to restore all civil rights and liberties and to set a timetable for elections. The Managua government has until September 30th, when current Contra funding expires, to meet those goals. If they do, the Reagan administration won't seek any more U.S. aid for the Contras. President Reagan said our Central American neighbors, the Contras and the Nicaraguan people, share common aspirations.
The establishment of genuinely democratic systems throughout the region with the fully guaranteed liberties of free assembly, free speech, free press, and the simple principle of self-determination.
Reagan administration officials admit there is some skepticism about their motives for this plan, but Secretary of State Schultz insists the proposal is genuine and not a ploy. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
NPR's Cokie Roberts reports on House Speaker Jim Wright's efforts to sell the new initiative on Capitol Hill.
The Texas Democratic Speaker of the House met with a former Texas Republican congressman in the White House to conceive the call for negotiations in Nicaragua. Some Democrats warned the speaker against working with the Reagan administration on this highly controversial issue, saying the president had made promises about negotiations before and failed to carry them out. These Democrats think the White House could be setting them up, expecting negotiations to fail so that Contra aid will be continued. The Democrats are trying hard to guard against that by insisting on independent observers at the negotiating table and exacting promises from the president that he won't speak out on the Contra aid issue while this effort is ongoing. That's got some Republicans angry. But for the most part, members of both parties are cautiously accepting this idea, saying it's impossible to reject the concept of peace in Central America. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
A Pentagon guard today shot to death a man who drew a handgun, demanded to discuss missiles, and bolted past a security station. Officials say Dwayne Wallace of Youngstown, Ohio, was shot as he ran toward the offices of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He died less than 2 hours later in the hospital. The USS Stark came home today to a hero's welcome from flag-waving friends and family. The Stark lost 37 crewmen when it was hit in an Iraqi missile attack on May 17th, and for many, the joy of today's homecoming was dimmed by the memory of those who died in the attack. But for 20 members of the Cummings family from Sandusky, Ohio, this was reunion day. They came to join Karen Cummings in welcoming home her son Kevin.
I'm very excited, very happy. I don't know what to say.
What did you say to him when you saw him?
I just cried. I asked him if he was sure he was okay, if he was happy to be home and on American land. That was about it. He was so busy hugging and kissing the 22 people we've got here.
106 crew members were on board the Stark today as it returned from its six-month tour of duty. American Motors stockholders today approved the company's $2 billion merger with Chrysler Corporation. AMC officials say more than 90% of the firm's shareholders agreed to the takeover. The Federal Trade Commission approved the buyout yesterday, clearing the way for today's vote. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 20 points. It closed out the day at 2566.65. Trading was active. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new reissue of the late Arturo Toscanini and his NBC Symphony Orchestra performing works by Berlioz. Toscanini conducted music by the 19th century French composer before it had become part of the standard repertoire.
It's one of the great ironies that the most popular conductor ever recorded should have been recorded so poorly. The thin, dry, tinny sound of Arturo Toscanini's records is notorious. And I'm talking about records made not in the early days of 78s, but in the late 40s and early 50s, when hi-fi was the new rule. Fortunately, in the past few years, digital and half-speed remastering, and now CDs, have helped restore some sonic life to the old records, a new clarity and presence, if not an actual change in the character of the sound itself. Toscanini is somewhat under a cloud these days, partly, I suspect, as a reaction to his extreme popularity, and partly, I think, because the conductors who most obviously imitate him don't have his musical genius. It seems that anyone who gets an orchestra to play fast and loud, with cold, hard-driven precision, is considered a disciple of Toscanini. But most of his recordings reveal that the crisp, precise attack he so ruthlessly demanded is there not only to create sacco climaxes, but actually to ensure a delicacy and variety of touch throughout, hairpin turns and dynamics and rhythm that help create a soaring, singing musical line. He was one of the first conductors dedicated to following the letter of a score, but he was never just a human metronome. Another common oversimplification about Toscanini has to do with his repertoire. Some people think he conducted only Beethoven, Italian operas, and short pops favorites. But that ignores his lifelong devotion to Wagner, his sublime performances of Haydn and Mozart, his rhythmically exhilarating Schumann, Mendelssohn, and Brahms, his muscular, energized Debussy. It's true he never liked or understood Mahler, but then no one complains about Wilhelm Furtwängler's lack of interest in Rossini or Verdi, or Berlioz, who's another composer we don't usually associate with Toscanini either. I'd like you to hear a passage from the kaleidoscopic third movement serenade from Berlioz's Harold in Italy, recorded at a live broadcast from Carnegie Hall in 1953 and just reissued on a new RCA CD. The eloquent soloist is Carlton Cooley, principal violist of the NBC Symphony.
Thank you.
Toscanini gave the first American performance of Harold in Italy with the New York Philharmonic in 1929. He recorded his first Berlioz in 1920, the Rakoczy March from the Damnation of Faust with the La Scala Orchestra. His breathtaking 1945 version is included on this new CD, along with the Roman Carnival Overture and the dazzlingly executed Queen Mab Scherzo. These lean and brilliant performances emphasize the sinuous, insinuating curve of Berlioz's melodies and the uncanny alteration of tension and release that is impossible to convey only in an excerpt. 6 months after this youthfully exuberant recording of Harold in Italy, Toscanini, at the age of 87, would lead his own great orchestra for the last time and retire.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He's a poet and teaches English and creative writing at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed an RCA reissue of Toscanini and the NBC Symphony Orchestra performing Berlioz. From that recording, this is the finale of Harold in Italy. You're listening to Fresh Air. It's been 25 years since the death of film star Marilyn Monroe, yet the public's fascination with her life and the events surrounding her death continues. Marilyn Monroe has been written about from many perspectives by authors ranging from Norman Mailer to sports writer Roger Kahn and feminist Gloria Steinem. Photographer Eve Arnold has written a book from the vantage point of having photographed Marilyn Monroe over a 10-year period. Her longest session with Monroe covered 2 months during the filming of The Misfits. Arnold has been a professional photojournalist for more than 35 years, taking pictures of people and current events in this country, Europe, the Soviet Union, and China. When Marilyn Monroe died, Eve Arnold embargoed her Monroe photographs. She's collected those photographs in her new book called Marilyn Monroe, An Appreciation, which also includes her extended essay about working with Monroe. When I spoke with Eve Arnold, I asked her why she waited so long to publish these photos.
Well, I think principally because I didn't want to believe that she was dead. And then it seemed somehow rather exploitative to do it, you know, to rush in selling things. I couldn't stand that idea. But over the years, so much has been done, which I find reprehensible, that I thought it was time for somebody who really knew her and didn't, you know, go around talking to people who knew people who knew people who may have known her, that it would be time to do something.
You've written that it was impossible to do candid photographs of Marilyn Monroe. Why was it impossible?
Because she was always aware of the camera. She always knew where a camera was, and it was like a radar screen for her. She would react. You would know that she knew. You couldn't just pretend not to be there. And she could pretend not to be there, so that sometimes it looks very candid. But my feeling is that it never was. It was always Marilyn who knew exactly where the camera was.
One of the photographs that you have of her, and I think this is maybe my favorite photograph in the book, it's a shot of her in the ladies' room. Her back is turned to the camera. She's fixing her hair and looking in the mirror. And she hasn't adjusted her dress yet, so her dress is hiked up to her thighs. And it's a photograph that I think any woman could relate to, because we've all been in that ladies' room and haven't adjusted our clothes yet and we're fixing our hair. And although you could see it as a very sexual photograph, it's just a very natural photograph. And it's very... It seems to me a shot a woman would take for reasons I can't quite explain, partially because it's in the ladies' room, but because it's such an unselfconscious shot.
Well, from the very beginning, She was simply herself, and I was the camera. And Inga Morath, who's married to Arthur Miller and is the other woman photographer that I know who photographed Marilyn, has said about her that she was the animal trainer. We, the photographers, were the beasts. And I think she knew how to use us, always gently, but always the way she wanted it.
How did she make you feel about yourself, being around someone as beautiful and as photogenic as her?
Well, I've never had her kind of ego about myself, but I've never particularly questioned what I was. I am what I am. And it gave me pleasure to look at her. It gave me pleasure to watch the antics of trying to seduce the whole world.
You describe Marilyn Monroe as having had a genius for still photographs. Now, in a lot of ways, I think of your specialty as the candid photograph. You've taken photographs of people around America and Europe and China, people who you don't know, who you find something intriguing about. And I guess you have respect for both forms, for the more posed photograph and for the candid photograph, for the photograph of the celebrated person and for the photograph of the uncelebrated person.
Well, I'm greedy. I like to photograph everything. And I don't draw any lines. It's a visual form. And very often, the chimney sweep is a more interesting person to photograph than the prime minister, and I've done both.
You've dealt with politicians, and it's one thing if Marilyn Monroe is manipulating the camera in order to project her sexual image, but it's another thing if, say, Joseph McCarthy is trying to manipulate the camera. Now, you did a series of shots of Joe McCarthy in the 1950s. Was there any question of that? I mean, was there a tug of war of how these photos were going to look?
No, never. You work from many bases, and I think the two significant ones are that you work from affection and concern, and you work from dislike and sometimes even hate of the person you're doing, but it's a positive reaction. I hated what McCarthy stood for, and whether it was conscious or unconscious, and I'm sure it was both, I wanted that to come through, and so the McCarthy pictures are not very nice. I think they're strong. I think they say about McCarthy what many people in this country felt about him and about that era. And that was my job, I felt, to show what existed.
There are some of the photographs that you took of McCarthy in an earlier book of yours. And in that book you wrote that the magazine who published the photograph put positive captions underneath and made it into a positive profile of him.
A pro-McCarthy. But this was done in Germany. This is early on when I didn't know enough.
But how did that make you feel to have your intentions totally subverted?
I was horrified. Not only did the Germans do it, the Italians did it too. And it was only many years later, not many, maybe 2 years after this happened, when I was sufficiently understanding of what was going on, that I was able, and I was well enough known, to demand that pictures must be used as is with my captions, that they couldn't be cropped, but even more important, that they couldn't be misrepresented.
You broke into photography when picture magazines were in their heyday. How has their decline changed the nature of your work and the nature of photography?
Well, I think the nature of photography has changed. I think that it's coming back a bit. I think the kind of documentary photography that I did in the 50s and 60s and 70s is now changed. If you look at most magazines, you will find that they're studio type of the kind we did in the 50s. Everything is beautifully front lit and in color and very attractive, but not with a great deal of substance. In my own case, I was very fortunate because I left the United States in the early 60s, just as Life magazine was coming to the end and all the other picture magazines were falling away. And I went to work in England, and I was under contract for 10 years to the Sunday Times, which is a wonderful color magazine for the first, it's 25 years old now, and I've worked for them for 25 years. And for those years, the early years, I did pretty much what I wanted, and they sent me all over the world. I went to Russia 3 times. I did a series on veiled women in Afghanistan and Egypt and the Arab Emirates. I just traveled around. When that was over, about 12 years ago, I started doing books. In the beginning, they were books from my own files. There was a book on called The Unretouched Woman about the women I'd photographed. Then there was the one you talked about with the McCarthy book about the 50s called Flashback. And then I started doing original books, beginning from scratch, like assignments. I did a book on China. I did a book on America. And but then I went back to the Maryland, this current one, which is out of files. But now I'm also, while I'm doing this, I'm shooting another book on Misha Baryshnikov.
Do you like to be photographed yourself?
Oh, I can't abide it. I know what that lens is going to do to me.
What's it going to do to you?
Well, I become self-conscious, and I think many people do.
Do you think your self-consciousness about being photographed makes you sensitive to the self-consciousness others have when you photograph them?
Yes, I'm very careful when I photograph. I try, if possible, unless there's a situation going on, I try to set a situation so the person can more or less forget about me and we can go on with things.
Do you carry photographs of your family in your wallet?
Not very often. Occasionally I do. It's very strange. I carry them in my head. I carry them in my heart. But it isn't necessary, I find.
So photographs don't have that role in your life?
Okay. Well, they've had such a huge role in my life that I don't think I've carried it over to my personal life.
Well, Eve Arnold, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your photographs.
Terry, thank you.
Eve Arnold's new book is called Marilyn Monroe and Appreciation. Marilyn Monroe died on August 4th, 1962. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you covering today?
Well, we're covering the official announcement of President Reagan's new Central America initiative and also a special report on black boycotts in at least a dozen small Mississippi towns where blacks are boycotting white business, demanding better hiring, more hiring of blacks at local school boards.
Is this part of your series on Black America Today?
Yes. In fact, we're also going to have an item specifically about 20 years after the long, hot summer, asking four black social policy thinkers whether they think we are still two separate societies, black and white, unequal.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our language commentator, Jeffrey Nunberg, is usage editor of the American Heritage Dictionary, so he's constantly monitoring changes in our language. Today he examines how a common noun can suddenly lead a double life as a verb.
If you could repeal one word, what would it be? Judging from the mail that comes into the American Heritage Dictionary, the most widely hated linguistic transgression of our age is the use of the noun impact as a verb, as in a sentence like, "Inflation impacted strongly on our operation." I've just been going over the citations we've been collecting for this usage, and I've got to admit that the people who complain about it are onto something. The earliest example that I found is from a 1967 speech by General William Westmoreland, assuring the American people that the most recent increases in American troop strength in Southeast Asia would, and I quote, impact not only on Vietnam, but on the whole developing world. In fact, it seems that generals are drawn to this verb. Not long ago, it popped up in a truly breathtaking piece of bureau prose by former Marine Corps Commandant P.X. Kelly, commenting on the Moscow Embassy spy scandal. Get this one. "We must not let the actions of a few remote individuals impact adversely on the image of the most unique fighting force that the world has ever known." Now, one piece of material like that is enough to keep a language critic in business for months. You can rail all you like about imprecise diction or sloppy syntax, but none of these vices is so entertainingly outrageous as the spectacle of a 4-star general crashing through the English language as if it were the surf off Omaha Beach. It's no wonder that language critics have made impact the number one pomposity of the 80s. Still, we should probably keep in mind that words like impact have a way of working themselves into the fabric of the language. You can see why impact would be so appealing to bureaucrats and their ilk, because it allows them to sound important while at the same time masking their ignorance. It not only provides a grandiose substitute for the verb effect, it also gets them out of the embarrassing problem of having to decide how to spell effect with an A or an E. That's why it was foregone that impact would become the common usage in bureaucratic circles. It seems you can't throw a rock nowadays without hitting somebody who's using impact as a verb, though mind you, I'm not suggesting that we should stop trying. But this leads us to a nice little moral dilemma. Once the usage of impact becomes standard, it's bound to lose its pretentious connotations. And at that point, there's every chance that we are going to sound like stuffy old farts for complaining about it. By way of analogy, it's worth recalling how critics a generation or two ago were raising the roof about the use of contact as a verb, as in, I'll contact you next week. One critic called it an abomination. Another called it a lubricious barbarism. The New York Times style manual said it was graceless and warned writers to stay away from it. Nowadays, of course, most people can't imagine what these fulminations were all about. Contact seems a perfectly serviceable verb, a concise way of saying get in touch with. But does the present acceptability of contact mean that the critics of the 50s were silly to have gotten so worked up about the word? And if so, is it possible that people a generation from now will wonder why we made such a fuss about a word as common and unexceptionable as impact? Maybe we've got it all wrong. Maybe we should be celebrating Generals Westmoreland and Kelly as linguistic pioneers. Well, no, that can't be right. Whatever the future of the verb, the generals deserve to be taken to task. The trick is to understand that it is not impact itself that we're objecting to, but people's reasons for using it. In General Kelly's mouth, it is six-bit bombast. In the mouth of one of his junior officers, it's ordinary linguistic currency. Like the man says, it's the singer, not the song.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On tomorrow's show, I'll speak with novelist Tom Clancy, whose bestsellers Red Storm Rising and The Hunt for Red October are about superpower conflicts. His new bestseller, The Patriot Game, is about international terrorism. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new album by Kid Creole and the Coconuts. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review the Disney classic Snow White, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KQED in San Francisco. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.